5 major worldviews. These are dominating worldviews that in some cases they overlap, especially as our culture becomes more and more non-religious or picks up different ideas from different systems of thought. And though there are major world religions, my goal isn't to try to cover all the different major world religions. There are many world religions, whether you want to refer to Buddhism or Hinduism. Those definitely are going to deceive thousands, if not millions. There's cults like Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses. And I'm not going to get into all of those necessarily. We may touch on some of those, but we are going to deal with Islam at some point because it does tend to have a dominating worldview because of the number of people and the number of countries that it affects. But today, we will look at least two, hopefully, maybe three, dominating or major worldviews. And we'll begin with, and I'm blending some of these together because they do overlap so much. And so we will look at these kind of together in one big overlapping group. And you'll find that we can separate some of these ideas maybe from the other. But this is a dominating worldview today. And again, it tends to blend itself sometimes with other religions and philosophies. But we have found that there are a lot of people that would find that they may not themselves classify themselves in this particular area, but this is the way that they think. So naturalism, secularism, atheism, they all kind of run together. And you'll find that when you meet people like this, and you may work with people, you may just be in a casual relationship with somebody, someone who is the regular server at the restaurant. Maybe it's somebody that you kind of have a casual acquaintance with, and you'll have a conversation with them, and you'll find them making statements that reveal the way they're thinking about the world. And this is a dominant thought, or a dominant philosophy, a dominant worldview, that we are here through evolutionary processes. There's a lot of people, especially with the talk of science today, this kind of worldview talks about science a lot. Now, help me out here. What does science mean? The definition of science. What really is science? I remember growing up and learning a certain definition. Knowledge, okay. But knowledge gained how? Ray?
Observation.
Okay, right. Good. Did I see another hand? Gloria? Or Earl or somebody? No? No? Somebody was scratching their head? Okay, all right. Adjusting their glasses? This is like an auction, right? You just got $100. Earl?
Something repeatable,
good, all right, good. Observable, repeatable, Ken?
Demonstrable.
Demonstrable or verifiable, good. It takes something that is observable and then has to be able to verify it, and that's where we come into experiments. So it's knowledge, yes, but it has to be verified. It has to be something that we can observe. So really, when you get into these worldviews, they'll act like, again, we use the phrase nowadays way too much, the science is settled. But really, when we define some of the things that are called science today, they're really not science. And then there's always something else involved when it comes to science. It's called the scientist. And a scientist comes with presuppositions, comes with certain ways of thinking, comes with many times a worldview already. And we've talked about already, I've used the illustration several times, the old exhibit at the Creation Museum, the very first one, showed two paleontologists studying the same fossil and coming up with two different conclusions because they both came to the same fossil with the same information. They derived the same facts, but they interpreted it two different ways. Now, again, if we go back to origins of life, can science truly determine the origin of life? No, it wasn't observable, and it's not necessarily verifiable in the normal sense of the way that we do experiments. We have to depend upon certain facts that we then have to make assumptions about. But again, as a creation, from a creation viewpoint, as a creationist, we go back to the eyewitness account. God, who was there, who created the world, revealed. And so we go back to the verifiable fact of God and his word, and not time, chance, and lady luck. And then we can look at certain things that we know are true about our creation and so on and so forth. But this is where often we see this worldview, we see them starting with a evolutionary or a science-based system of thought. And they often argue from the vantage point of we got here through evolutionary processes, and so therefore anything that has to do with science can't explain the universe and the way we think and why we do things. Oftentimes, these people are non-religious, or they may refer to themselves in some way as agnostic. Now, we have in our culture today a group of people, it's a very large group of people that are called the nones or the nuns, not the N-U-N-S nuns, but the nones or the nuns. They are not involved really with any kind of faith-based organization, church, group. And these people, even many of them, are no longer involved in community groups. It's an interesting phenomenon. It's kind of scary to think that we as people could get to the point where we ostracize ourselves from other people. In our selfish culture in which we live, and I am my own, now we're hearing terms like, I think Aaron Rodgers used it when he was explaining why he didn't take the vaccine, and now he's not able to play this Sunday or today. And he used the term bodily autonomy. Whoa, bodily autonomy. I believe in bodily autonomy, he said. All right, okay. Well, he was breaking that down for the naysayers and explaining why he didn't take the vaccine. But that phrase stood out to me because people now are using that phrase to excuse their immoral lifestyle, to excuse their changing of their sexual orientation, their gender identity. And that phrase is becoming a code phrase for excusing lots of different types of sins and excusing why I can treat people a certain way and so on and so forth. Well, this group of people often are non-religious, and if they admit to anything, they may classify themselves as agnostic. But oftentimes, they're not involved in any kind of church or faith-based organization. And many times, they're not even involved in their community. Some are, but there's fewer people who are involved in things like bowling leagues and Little League that are involved in other kinds of clubs. I don't know all the different kinds of social clubs. There's the Optimist, and there's the Eagles, and there's the Owls. And I don't know, all the different groups. There's all kinds of social clubs. And we're finding that fewer people are even involved in those. You used to be able to walk up to somebody, and even if they didn't go to church, they were active in some community organization. We're finding fewer people are involved. Now, COVID hasn't done any service to this. Obviously, COVID has made it worse. But when people begin to leave community and social type of organizations, they either become very self-focused or they drop out of society altogether, and then we have epidemics of suicide and loneliness, and then we meet people through the headline news who have massacred people, and then they talk about this person and they say, oh, they were a loner, or there was nothing about them that seemed to be violent. Well, then they go in and they do their searches on their computer, and what do they find? They were in a very dark place on the internet. They were in a very dark place on their phones. They were in a very dark place in their in the things that they read and what they wore. They had removed themselves from all accountability from society. And that's one of the sad things about the internet now. It's one of the sad things about devices being on our person 24/7. We can kind of go into a black hole and live only unto ourselves. And some people, they will show up for work and then go back home and they just live in their little bubble. And then now what's Zuckerberg? Metaverse? Have you heard that the parent name for Facebook? The company has now changed to Meta or Metaverse, and he's going to create a virtual world. Now you can create your own avatar. His goal is for everybody to live in their own virtual world. You can put on VR reality goggles. You can live in a virtual world. Isn't that scary? I can completely remove myself from every human relationship and literally live in an internet-based world. And I can have my own virtual world in which I am the king, because we know that's what it's going to be, right? I'm going to be the king. Who's going to be the servant in the virtual world? Everybody's going to create their own little kingdom, and they're all going to live in their own little VR world and rule their own little world and do whatever they want and make up their own values and morals. I mean, it's really scary to think. That's where this leads to. They often have technological and scientific explanations and answers. Everything is going to be, well, the science says, the research, the study shows. And have you noticed that a lot of these research-based studies, they ignore other alternative views? As a matter of fact, there was somebody who, in one of the big-name colleges, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, one of those Ivy League schools, they did research on the gender fluidity of teenage girls. And they revealed in their study that a lot of the gender fluidity in teenage girls is the direct result of peer pressure, even YouTube stars. And she released this to the public, and she immediately got slammed by the media. I think she had to retract her story, even though she had it scientifically proven with research and peer review and all that jargon. She had to pull it down, and she was making apologies publicly, though, from what I understand, privately, she was saying, yeah, I'm right, okay? And it was a very revealing scientific study that got slammed, okay? And again, they argue because we have this newer technology, because we are more advanced than Cro-Magnon man back in the rock ages, the stone ages or whatever, you know, because we're so advanced now, it's that whole chronological snobbery that C.S. Lewis talks about, and we don't have any place for the old and for history and so on and so forth. So what is life about? Life is about control. What serves me in particular, what serves us best in this lifetime? And where does this go? So again, if it's evolutionary in its thought, in its origin, then life is about control, because I, as man, can control everything. I create my own destiny. How did we get here? Through survival of the fittest, natural selection. So we can control the environment. We can control our destiny. We can create our own destiny. On and on and on it goes. So if we're just a higher form of animal, then love, is about instinct. It's about impulses. It's about survival. So, I was reading in my study this book was talking about a particular philosopher, scientist, whatever his title was, and I forget if it was Freud or forget the name of the, maybe it was the psychologist. Anyway, the only reason why in his belief system, the only reason why a mother loves her child is because she owes her survival to that child, or she owes mankind's survival to that child. There's an instinct, unexplained, but nevertheless, an instinct that somewhere in the evolutionary eons of time, the mother desired to have a child, and somehow then, through evolution, time, chance, millions of years, and lady luck, that female, which now is no longer a scientific fact, supposedly. This gets really confusing, I know. But somewhere, that female decided she wanted to have children and then was able to evolve the proper biology to do that. And then through that instinct for whom she bore, now she knows that she owes her survival and the survival of mankind to that child. So everything is explained in an instinctive, animalistic kind of way. It gets ridiculous, doesn't it? So now what is a relationship between a mom and a child? It can be any kind of alternative. See where this goes? When we start thinking this way, when we start taking this to its logical end, then who needs the family? Who needs the nuclear family? It's all based on instincts anyway, and Freud was a pervert. Freud was a sexual pervert. And he made everything the impulse of Eros, or the libido, or whatever. And it all became sexual. The guy was a complete pervert. Darwin was a racist. Darwin even admitted before he died that he didn't have explanations for certain things. Genetic code, DNA, has blown Darwin's theory out of the water. And we know all kinds of things about chemical components and all kinds of other things now. But we still hear the science is settled. You still walk into museums millions of years. The logical end of this is we're just a higher form of animal, and everything we do, every relationship we have, is based on instinct, impulse, and survival. And it gets scary when that plays out socially. So then what is evil? It is fate. Let's see here. There's a Christmas song, famous Christmas song. We play it all the time at Christmas time. Through the years, we'll always be together. And then what's she say? Or he say, as they're singing. As what? If the fate allows. Okay, I'm not saying you can't play that song around your house. I'm not saying, you know, you are a grave sinner if you play that song. But think about it. What is that saying? That fate is what we are all in. Okay, if we're in survival mode as a greater form of animal, then we are dependent on and hopeful that fate will allow us to get together at Christmas. Well, if the government allows us, you know, we found out we have to even vote for Christmas, I guess. So anyway, evil is fate, chance. And then you get into all the spiritism of that, and you get into, what was it, who was the guy, the Beatles? I think the Beatles had a song. What was his name? John Lennon. And the instant karma's going to get you, going to get you right in the face. Pull yourself together, darling. It's the dawn of the human race. That was a big song back before I was born. But it was a very, very popular Nike commercial when I was growing up in the 80s and early 90s. And you study out that song a little bit, and it's nothing but spiritism and New Age and this idea of fate and karma. You know, you do something good, and that puts some points out there for your fate. So karma's going to get you. Good karma. You got to create good karma. It becomes superstition. You put on the same sweaty socks the same way every time you go and you play a game where you go. I mean, before long, you're living in this constant superstitious, oh, I did it this way and it worked, and so I have good luck. And that's good karma. I mean, it just keeps going and going and going. Well, you have this evolutionary thought superimposed on society, and then everything that's evil is biologically or culturally caused. Now, this is what I've always questioned people with. If society makes us evil, then how did society get evil in the first place? They blame, right? Society is to blame. I was listening to the news, and we see it. It's local as well, but Indianapolis, just had a ceasefire, a 72-hour ceasefire. 215 homicides in Indianapolis as of like October 1st, something like that, or November 1st. New records. And the mayor came out, and we're going to have a 72-hour ceasefire. And we're going to have the 10-point coalition come in, and we're going to have drive-by prayer meetings, and we're going to put candles out. And what do they always leave out when they talk about trying to solve crime? You can talk about gun laws, you can talk about this, that, and the other, but what's his name? Mayor Emanuel, whatever his name, Rahm Emanuel, whatever, who was kind of like Obama's sidekick. He was the mayor of Chicago, and he had the audacity several years ago to come out and say, we need to take a look at the family and look at family structure and what parents are doing at home. And he got ripped to shreds. He was right. I mean, I don't agree with that guy and his politics on probably 99.9%. But he was right. When he got sick and tired of the crime as the mayor of Chicago, he came out and said, we need to take a look at the family. And I mean, he had to retract and apologize, and he was, you know, like a whipped puppy with its tail between its legs, because he had the audacity to say that the problem with the gangs and the violence in the society might have to do with the family. Well, if you base everything on instinct, impulse, and survival, then who's wrong and who's right? And what's the family anyway? If the mom and the dad are only in survival mode and they don't necessarily see their child as the way to human flourishing, on and on and on we go. The social Darwinism comes out. It's biologically, it's culturally caused. They have certain biological issues, they have certain cultural issues, and it never gets to the root of the problem, which is sin. And the solution, which is salvation by faith alone and Christ alone in biblical principles. So evil can be eliminated. How? Man's advancement. Again, I've said this illustration before. If this is how we survive, then the doctor ought to go to the mom whose little child is dying of cancer at Riley Hospital or Peyton Manning's Children's Hospital and say to that child at St. Jude, thank you for your contribution to this evolutionary stage of human existence. If your child dies, at least they made some positive contribution, and now we have some more science that we can use for our research to find a cure. No hope, no purpose, no heaven, no sin, no salvation, no redemption. Just if we take everything and call all the social ills and all the problems in society as simply culturally or biologically based, then every person who's dying of COVID or cancer or heart disease or whatever, they are just simply in this evolutionary stage hoping to make things better for the next stage. Where does that lead people? What kind of hope? What kind of joy? What kind of purpose? So man's advancement in science, medicine, and I put morality in quotation marks, obviously, because whose view of morality? You've heard it said, something along the lines of, we have a new morality. Or, what was it the other day I was reading? And it was immoral. It was immoral to believe that a woman doesn't have reproductive rights over her own body. The immoral people are the people who actually believe that child, that preborn child, is a human being that deserves life. That was the immoral position. Because we are more advanced than that now. That, you hear that kind of lingo. That's the way this worldview operates. Advancement in science, medicine, morality, technology, all will end evil. Evil is mitigated by what? Removing the people who won't change their mind. Who won't get in, how do they phrase it? Somebody help me out here if you can, if you get the right side of history. You got to get on the right side of history. There are people who believe that what we are doing right now as a church family is on the wrong side of history. We need to get on the right side of history. And we need to give up this church thing, this religion thing, this faith thing, because we probably hold to views. We probably hold to views that are not going to promote the advancement of mankind according to this worldview. Do you get what I'm saying? So it's nothing for a politician with this kind of mindset to say, why not close down the church? Why do we continue to put up with these anti-abortion people? These, I know they call us homophobic. We're not fearful of homosexuality. We just believe what the Bible says about mankind and sexuality. But you know what? They use all these phrases, and they're labeling all those who they claim are not advancing the human race. So they are defining morality. They're defining what is advancement. They're defining all these things based on a worldview that says we are here. We can control this. We can make life better. We can bring in this utopia, so on and so forth. So they have to dehumanize the opponent. They have to remove those who won't get on board because they stand in the way. So then what is the purpose of life? To make positive contributions to society and to the environment. That's basically what we're here for, is to promote this particular stage of evolution so we can survive to the next one. And it gets intermingled. I know there are religious aspects for some people that they bring in. But having said all that, if I can get the video to play, I don't know if I'll have good audio, but I'll try to play a video here in a minute. But before I go any further, questions or comments up to this point? Okay, let's see if this video will play. I don't know. Oh, I forgot. I'm sorry, I forgot one more point. If they usually don't believe in an afterlife. If they do admit to an afterlife, heaven is for a good person. There might be heaven. There's definitely no hell. But if there is a heaven, then it's only for those who are good enough, who measure up. Earl? I'll touch on that maybe a little bit, not exactly, but feel free to bring that up again if I don't get to it. There's another worldview that may touch on that a little bit. One thing that I do remember talking with a gentleman years ago, and he had this kind of worldview, he had this mindset, and I asked him specifically about heaven and hell, and he denied the existence of heaven, and he said this. He said, hell is what we create here on this earth when we don't make good choices. When we don't do the right things, tolerance, so on and so forth, we create our own hell on this earth. And then we cease to exist after that. That was basically how he, and I was trying to witness to him, but he was stuck on that view. But that was how he explained the lack of an afterlife. Yes.
Mm-hmm. She thinks that when you die at the end.
Right.
But she hasn't figured out what ghosts are.
What ghosts are?
She said that you might turn into a ghost.
Okay. Yeah.
Some people just haven't figured it out yet.
Right, right. And it's a sad way to live. And that's where we hopefully can bring them back to, well, God has told us what happens. And he's made a plan. He has a plan of redemption. But yeah, I remember being in Africa. And they had a lot of spiritism in their religion, in their tribal religions. And they believed that ghosts were real, but they were the spirits of their loved ones who came back and haunted them. So what they literally believed is if you did not mourn over the death, you could have hated somebody in your family. Just despised them. They could have been just royal jerks. But if you did not show enough sadness at their funeral, they believed that their spirit would come back and haunt them. So they would hire professional mourners. They would go and they would wail at the funerals, just in hopes that that dead loved one would not come back and haunt them. Well, then, it actually turned into demonic activity. Because they would, as in their tribe, depending on their custom, their tribe, their tribal religion would teach them to basically worship the spirits, the ghosts, and to offer incense and sacrifices. And well, what was it? Paul talks about idols being not being real things, but he talks about demonic forces behind those idols. And so the missionaries, they were trying to help these people understand, even as a believer, if you get carried away in this spiritism of your ancestors and praying for the dead and all that, they would talk about how they are opening themselves up to demonic activity, even as believers. Scary. But that's that kind of thinking. There are ghosts that are haunting. They don't have an explanation for it. In Africa, they were saying it's my dead ancestors, my dead relatives, who I didn't cry hard enough for at their funeral. I didn't treat them nice enough while they were alive or something, and they were coming back to haunt me. Scary. Scary thoughts. Let's see if we can get this to play. I don't know if it'll work or not, but... Yes. That's a good idea.
Modern science was started by Christians. Many of the founders of modern science were Christians. Men like Galileo, Kepler, Pascal, Boyle, Newton, Faraday, and Clerk Maxwell were all firm believers in God. They weren't scientists despite being Christians. It was their faith that moved them to want to discover more about the natural world they lived in. As C.S. Lewis wrote, men became scientists because they expected law in nature, and they expected law in nature because they believed in a legislator. Far from hindering modern science, faith in God was one of the motors that drove it. Second, many of the best scientists today are people of faith. Between 1901 and 2000, over 60% of Nobel laureates were Christians. If our best scientists are people with deep, sincere religious faith, there may be a misunderstanding by some about what religious faith is, but there cannot be an essential conflict between being a scientist and faith in God. Third, science explains how. Religion explains why. One reason science and faith are not in conflict is that they are complementary. Imagine there's a boiling pot of water, and someone asks, "Why is this water boiling?" You could say, "Because heat energy from the gas flame is being conducted through the copper base of the kettle and is agitating the molecules of the water to such an extent that the water is boiling." This is a true statement. But you could also answer by saying, "Because I wanted a cup of tea." Though very different, this is also a true statement. One answer explains how the water boils, while the other answer explains what caused the conditions that made it boil. So it is with science and religion. They are not in conflict, they are complementary, as we seek to understand both how and why. Fourth, science can't explain everything. Science describes the laws of nature, but it can't explain where matter came from. It can't explain how life began. It can't explain the purpose of our lives, what it means to love, or why we desire to do things we know we shouldn't do. It's not only possible to be curious about those big questions as well as scientific questions, but it's strange not to. The fact is, science and religion are not a mutually exclusive choice. Instead, it's more like learning to walk and chew gum. So next time someone tells you science and religion are in conflict, remember these four things. Modern science was started by Christians. You don't start fields of study you don't believe in. Many of the best scientists today are people of faith. 60% of Nobel laureates in the 20th century were Christians. Science considers how. Religion considers why. They aren't in conflict. They are complementary. And science doesn't explain everything. It's not only okay to think about things beyond the realm of science. It's healthy. For What Would You Say? I'm Joseph Backholm. If you like this video, let us know below. If you want to make sure you see the next one, hit subscribe.
Hopefully that helped a little bit with how we as believers can respond to this kind of thinking. Let me go back here. So that brings us to a second worldview. I know there's a lot of things more we could say about science and the worldview we just talked about, but we hear all the time, it seems like, that the two are contradictory, and I like how he described that they're complementary. And the Bible is not a science textbook, but everything that is scientific, everything the Bible says about science is accurate and true. All right, so postmodernism. We are literally in a postmodern world. I heard a lot about postmodernism when I was in college, and that was 20 years ago plus now. So it's now in a postmodern world. And I was introduced to this thought, this worldview. It really made sense when I was reading, and I haven't finished the book yet, but Carl Truman's book, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. I borrowed some of this from his book, and I'm hoping to be able to finish it someday. But he described a worldview that is so prevalent in our society. And again, some of these overlap and blend together, but emotivism. And the idea is that everything about life has to be described in psychological or therapeutic terms. We live in a very psychologized society. We live in a very therapeutic society. There was a Christian comedian who fell in moral sin, scandal, and he dropped out of his national tour of comedy. He came back recently, and his apology, I was listening to it, and I was listening to a Christian commentator talk about his apology, and it was very interesting. I thought that the commentator made a very good point. His apology, and now he's back on the national circle, and he's a funny guy. He's not somebody I particularly care to follow when it comes to Christian humor, clean humor, but that's beside the point. His apology had very little to say biblically. There was very little about sin and repentance. His apology was very therapeutic. I'm sorry for the harm that I caused, the disappointment that I caused. I'm sorry for the people who were disappointed in me, the hurt. He used all these therapeutic terms and psychological terms, and almost nothing that he said in his apology had anything to do with his personal sin and that he had repented. He talked about counseling. He talked about some therapists. But it just was another way in which we see the psychology of our society even affecting the church and Christianity. And this is one of the scariest things about this cultural mindset now. Life is about feelings, happiness, and pleasure. I've told people this. And I know that we enjoy our downtime. We all need downtime. We all need a hobby. We all need something that we can have as a diversion. But it's almost as if diversions and downtime and vacations and pleasure and entertainment, it's almost as if that is now the number one human right. So I'll sometimes say something like this. You are not, I've told students this at school who just wanted to goof off all the time. I said, we are not, there is no amendment in the Constitution that says that you are owed your favorite entertainment options every day, all the time. And after you get all of those favorite entertainment options to your greatest content, then you can work, then you can study, then you can actually go out and do the things you're supposed to do. But you first of all have to get all of those greatest entertainment options fulfilled first. Kind of scary when we start looking at, do you get a report, a weekly report on your phone use or your app use? It's kind of scary sometimes, isn't it? When you get that report and it's like 15 hours on YouTube, you know? Or I know there's lots of ways we can study our Bibles, but we may have a Bible app, and the Bible app's like 5 minutes. But YouTube's got like 15. And then there's your browser, whatever it is, your Safari or your Chrome or whatever, your Samsung, whatever your app is for your browser, and it shows like 20 hours. What was I doing all that time on the internet? What was I? And I do a lot of digital reading. I have a Kindle, white paper Kindle Fire. I really enjoy digital downloads to that, and I'm on Amazon Prime, so I can get like a free book every month and stuff like that. So there's ways in which we can digitize our educational and our spiritual, our Bible apps, good devotionals that are out there that are digitized. I understand we have electronic resources for our spiritual needs, but there's still something about opening up a paper copy of the Bible and writing things down and taking notes and highlighting, because the danger is when we're on our phones, a notification pops up and we go from reading in our devotions to surfing the net and checking the news. But I'm praying for the politicians, right? That's what our excuse in our minds is. Oh, I had to go to Fox News. I had to go to Newsmax or One World Now or whatever, you know, One America. I had to go to that because I was praying for the politicians. That's what we do. We spiritualize our surfing the net. Unfortunately, I'm guilty of switching over to the news when I should be reading something more important. And then in my own mind, I'm rationalizing, well, I prayed for President Biden while I was reading the headline. You know, I mean, we got to be careful, but we can get caught up in this entertainment mindset. And everything is about entertainment. Education, one of the things I struggled with in the final years that I was school administrator was it just seemed like I was pummeled with these advertisements for how to make education more entertaining. I'll sell you a math help program. It'll revolutionize your school. It'll increase your math scores at your school. If you can just get this math program and you do the little tutorial on it, and it's basically 1980s Atari, and it's got these little figures, and it's making math interesting. Well, the kids still have to learn the math. There's still something about a human body standing up in front of kids and engaging with them and having a relationship with them that does a world of good to education. But now we can go to a screen and we can click it on, and oh, my kids' math scores are going to go out the roof because they have a digital math program. Well, we've learned real quick in education that those electronic math programs were supplementary. They were help, but they did not replace a human body sitting with a student or a group of kids, teaching them and helping them and coming alongside them. As a teacher, you can recognize sometimes one glimmer in a child's eye. Okay, they didn't get that. You go back and you go over it, or you take a little extra time with them. A computer doesn't do that. A computer says, you didn't get 50, so you got to go back and do it again. You know, on and on it goes. Well, what does it do? It creates in a child, if we're not careful, this is one of the things I was learning in education. If I am not careful, I can lead our school in education to be about entertainment. So every classroom now has to have a YouTube star in order for them to learn anything. I told parents one year at an orientation meeting, I said, our teachers are not going to be able to compete with the YouTube stars that your children are watching at home. And parents looked at me and their jaws dropped. How could you say that? You know, it's like, I was trying to help the parents understand that our job as a school was not to entertain your children. Now, it doesn't mean that we can't have fun at school and that learning can't be fun. But now it's gotten into the church, hasn't it? Church has become an entertainment place. Church has become a place where I get my Jesus on. Church becomes a place where we have a performance. And in the performance, we can feel good and we can get excited. And then I heard just recently, I was listening to a Christian podcast, and this man came out of the Christian contemporary music movement in its early days. And here's what he said. He said, I am listening to a young person in their 20s who's at a rock concert. And he said this, he admitted, he said, why do I get the same feeling at my rock concert that I get in my Sunday morning church service? And he said, there was something wrong. There was something wrong in my thinking. And he got right with God, and he's talking about how it changed his life Because he said, I shouldn't get the same feeling in my Sunday morning church service that I'm getting at my rock concert on Tuesday night during the week. Why are those two feelings the same? Interesting thought, isn't it? I'm listening to this guy, and he's describing this, and I'm thinking, wow, what does that say about the church? The church has psychologized, or however you pronounce that word. The church has psychologized its worship. The church has gone to feelings-based and gone to entertainment and gone to happiness and gone to pleasure. And that just feeds into the charismatic movement. And it also feeds into, because what are feelings? Feelings are, they become very self-identified. How I feel. Now, I'll have to admit, when I got up this morning, my first feeling wasn't, I know this sounds carnal, okay, but my first feeling when I got up this morning wasn't, yay, I get to go to church and preach. I know that sounds really carnal. I'm sorry, okay? That wasn't the first thought when I got up this morning. As a matter of fact, when I got out of bed, the first thought I had was, my back doesn't hurt as bad as it did yesterday. Well, I have to admit, because I was doing some work around the house on Friday, and my back hurts so bad Friday night, and I put some cream on it last night hoping that it wouldn't hurt as bad. So when I woke up this morning and I crawled out of bed, I was like, yes, my back doesn't hurt as bad. But we do that, don't we? We do it based on feelings. How many times have we as parents had our kids wake up and they don't feel like going to school? Or don't feel like going to church? Or how many times have we felt like not going to work? But look at where we're at in our society. See how this all plays in? If we are in an emotivistic society, if we're in a post-postmodern society, and I make up my own truth, and truth is whatever I decide, and my personal feelings and my happiness is what decides what is best and what is right for me, well, if I don't feel like going to work, hey, I can get a government paycheck. I can get somebody else to bail me out. As a matter of fact, I can go down the street and I can sell some stuff. And it'll get me what I want and it'll make me feel good. Where does that go? Why do we have an opioid epidemic? Why do we have drug epidemic? I mean, on and on. We get caught up in this. And life, my identity, excuse me, then becomes who I believe that I am. So now we actually have people who say, I am a man trapped in a woman's body. Or I am a woman trapped in a man's body. And people actually believe that. How did that ever come to a point where that is accepted in society and legislated and ordered by our government? How did that happen? This worldview. This is the thinking. This comes right out, can I just say it? This comes right out of the pits of hell. This comes right out of Satan's mouth when he says to Eve, what did God say? God's keeping something from you. You see that tree over there? Knowledge of good and evil. God's keeping something from you. You can have it. This Garden of Eden is not that great after all. Oh, God says it's perfect, but there's something more for you. Just eat that forbidden fruit. And God will, or you will have knowledge of good and evil. You will be as God. The lies. He just repackages them, right? The names and the faces change, but the sin, the wrong philosophies remain the same. We're almost out of time, so we'll just do a couple more thoughts here. But this is where it leads, doesn't it? It leads to, I define truth for myself. IKEA is down in Fishers, and they have different stores up in Chicago and such. I remember an IKEA commercial last Christmas, advertisement for IKEA, and it's a lesbian going to work at IKEA. And I'm not saying you can't shop at IKEA. I'm just saying this was the advertisement. I distinctly remember this lesbian talking about working at IKEA, and she said, I love working at IKEA because I am tolerated by my, and she used different terms about, you know, her employer, speaking of IKEA, I am tolerated and I know I can speak my truth and it is tolerated at my workplace. I thought, your truth? Your truth. There was a reason The reason IKEA chose a lesbian, and there was a reason why that particular advertisement. And how does that sell furniture? But what if tolerance is the greatest virtue, then they are a virtuous company because they have people who they define their own truth and they live their own truth. And I thought, so if you go into IKEA and you want a bunch of stuff as an employee and you don't even like the employee discount and you just want to walk out of that store and take all that stuff for free, don't you get to just define that truth for yourself? Why does that not apply to the purchasing and the price? But it does apply to your made-up morality. You see what I'm saying? In my mind, I'm sitting there thinking, if you get to define your own truth, why don't you just change the price of the items and walk out of the store with whatever it is? You don't like that furniture for $89? Well, make it $5. You get to define the truth for yourself. All right? So tolerance then becomes the greatest virtue. And we hear and we see yard signs, just be kind. Niceness, customer service. Well, who defines what nice is? Who defines what kindness is? Who defines what love is? So we can go on and on. If I define truth for myself, it almost becomes anything goes. Yes? Yes, right. There are no absolutes except for the absolute, right? of whatever statement they make. Yes, Diane? Yes. Right, right. And you can have a good therapist, you can have a good medical doctor, but there still has to be a spiritual component, and that spiritual component has to come from the Bible. And so a good therapist or a good doctor still has to have respect for the Word of God, still has to understand that there is a spiritual component to man. And that's where it's so important that the counseling that we get comes from a biblical worldview. And identifies the realities that the Bible describes about our body, about all kinds of things. Jake, yes.
It's interesting hearing these different worldviews and how self-destructive they are and how flawed they are. I just hear you talk about it so easily. It just crumbles that you're talking about them. It's just reassuring to think about how our worldviews are so built on
Yes. Right. So now you have people who are saying it's okay to abort a preborn child, even admitting that it's a human life because they haven't achieved personhood. So now you'll see the argument, especially with the Texas abortion law, now they start talking about personhood. That child, okay, we'll admit it's a human, but it hasn't achieved personhood. Interesting how they start changing the terms. Well, what defines what a person is? Here we go, right? Now we get back to this, and again, we leave the absolute standard of God's word. Every man does what is right in his own eyes. All right, we're out of time. Dan, do you mind closing us in prayer? And then we'll be dismissed. Get ready for the service. Amen. All right, we'll be back to start the service in about 15 minutes.